What is your plan?
I want to volley-fire my tanks before firing my artillery. Why spoil the surprise, Gennady?
Sinyavsky asked cruelly.
We are ready for them here.
Understood. Good luck, Yuri.
And what of the other missions?
Boyar is moving now, and the Americans are about to deploy their magical pigs. If you can handle the leading Chinese elements, those behind ought to be roughly handled.
You can rape their daughters for all I care, Gennady.
That is nekulturni, Yuri.
Perhaps their wives, he suggested, adding,
We are watching you on the television now.
Then I will smile for the cameras, Sinyavsky promised.
The orbiting F-16 fighters were under the tactical command of Major General Gus Wallace. But he, at the moment, was under the command, or at least operating under the direction, of a Russian, General Colonel Gennady Bondarenko, who was in turn guided by the action of this skinny young Major Tucker and Grace Kelly, a soulless drone hovering over the battlefield.
There they go, General, Tucker said, as the leading Chinese echelons resumed their drive north.
I think it is time, then.
He looked to Colonel Aliyev, who nodded agreement. Bondarenko lifted the satellite phone.
General Wallace?
I'm here.
Please release your aircraft.
Roger that. Out.
And Wallace shifted phone receivers.
Eagle One, this is Rough Rider. Execute, execute, execute. Acknowledge.
Roger that, sir. Copy your order to execute. Executing now. Out.
And the colonel on the lead AWACS shifted to a different frequency. Cadillac lead, this is Eagle One. Execute your attack. Over.
Roger that, the colonel heard.
Going down now. Out.
The F-16s had been circling above the isolated clouds. Their threat receivers chirped a little bit, reporting the emissions of SAM radars somewhere down there. But the types indicated couldn't reach this high, and their jammer pods were all on anyway. On command, the sleek fighters changed course for the battlefield far below and to their west. Their GPS locators told them exactly where they were, and they also knew where their targets were, and the mission became a strictly technical exercise. Under the wings of each aircraft were the smart pigs, four to the fighter, with 48 fighters that came to 192 JSOWs. Each of these was a canister 13 feet long and not quite 2 feet wide, filled with blue 108 submunitions, 20 per container. The fighter pilots punched the release triggers, dropped their bombs, and then angled for home, letting the robots do the rest of the work. The Dark Star tapes would later tell them how they'd done. The smart pigs separated from the fighters, extended their own little wings to guide themselves the rest of the way to the target area. They knew this information, having been programmed by the fighters, and were now able to follow guidance from their own GPS receivers. This they did, acting in accordance with their own onboard mini-computers, until each reached a spot 5,000 feet over their designated segment of the battlefield. They didn't know that this was directly over the real estate occupied by the Chinese 29th Type A Group Army and its three heavy divisions, which included nearly 700 main battle tanks, 300 armored personnel carriers, and 100 mobile guns. That made a total of roughly 1,000 targets for the nearly 4,000 descending submunitions. But the falling bomblets were guided, too, and each had a seeker looking for heat of the sort radiated by an operating tank, personnel carrier, self-propelled gun, or truck. There were a lot of them to look for. No one saw them coming. They were small, no larger really than a common crow, and falling rapidly. They were also painted white, which helped them blend into the morning sky. Each had a rudimentary steering mechanism, and at an altitude of 2,000 feet they started looking for and homing in on targets. Their downward speed was such that a minor deflection of their control vanes was sufficient to get them close, and close meant straight down. They exploded in bunches almost in the same instant. Each contained a pound and a half of high explosive, the heat from which melted the metal casing, which then turned into a projectile. The process was called self-forging, which blazed downward at a speed of 10,000 feet per second. The armor on the top of a tank is always the thinnest, and five times the thickness would have made no difference. Of the 921 tanks on the field, 762 took hits, and the least of these destroyed the vehicle's diesel engine. Those less fortunate took hits through the turret, which killed the crews at once and/or ignited the ammunition storage, converting each armored vehicle into a small man-fabricated volcano. Just that quickly, three mechanized divisions were changed into one badly shaken and disorganized brigade. The infantry carriers fared no better, and it was worst of all for the trucks, most of them carrying ammunition or other flammable supplies. All in all, it took less than 90 seconds to turn 29th Type A Group Army into a thinly spread junkyard and funeral pyre.
"Holy God," Ryan said, "is this for real?"
"Seeing is believing. Jack, when they came to me with the idea for JSOW, I thought it had to be something from a science fiction book. Then they demoed the submunitions out at China Lake, and I thought, Jesus, we don't need the Army or the Marines anymore. Just send over some F-18s and then a brigade of trucks full of body bags and some ministers to pray over them. Eh, Mickey?"
"It's some capability," General Moore agreed.
He shook his head.
"Damn, just like the tests."
"Okay, what's happening next?"
Next was just off the coast near Guangzhou. Two Aegis cruisers, Mobile Bay and Princeton, plus the destroyers Fletcher, Fife, and John Young, steamed in line-ahead formation out of the morning fog and turned broadside to the shore. There was actually a decent beach at this spot. There was nothing much behind it, just a coastal defense missile battery that the fighter bombers had immolated a few hours before. To finish that job, the ships trained their guns to port and let loose a barrage of 5-inch shells. The crack and thunder of the gunfire could be heard on shore, as was the shriek of the shells passing overhead, and the explosions of the detonations. That included one missile that the bombs of the previous night had missed, plus the crew getting it ready for launch. People living nearby saw the gray silhouettes against the morning sky, and many of them got on the telephone to report what they saw. But being civilians, they reported the wrong thing, of course. It was just after 9 in the morning in Beijing when the Politburo began its emergency session. Some of those present had enjoyed a restful night's sleep, and then been disturbed by the news that came over the phone at breakfast. Those better informed had hardly slept at all past 3 in the morning, and, though more awake than their colleagues, were not in a happier mood.
"Well, Luo, what is happening?"
Interior Minister Tong Jie asked.
"Our enemies counterattacked last night. This sort of thing we must expect, of course," he admitted in as low-key a voice as circumstances permitted.
"How serious were these counterattacks?" Tong asked.
"The most serious involved some damage to railroad bridges in Harbin and Beiyan, but repairs are underway."
"I hope so. The repair effort will require some months," Chan Kun interjected.
"Who said that?" Luo demanded harshly.
"Marshal, I supervised the construction of two of those bridges. This morning I called the division superintendent for our state railroad in Harbin. All 6 of them have been destroyed. The piers on both sides of the river are totally wrecked. It will take over a month just to clear the debris."
"I admit this surprised me. Those bridges were very sturdily built, but the division superintendent tells me they are quite beyond repair."
"And who is this defeatist?" Luo demanded.
"He is a loyal party member of long standing and a very competent engineer, whom you will not threaten in my presence," Chan shot back. "There is room in this building for many things, but there is not room here for a lie."
"Oh, come now, Chan," Zhang Hansan soothed. "We need not have that sort of language here. Now, Luo, how bad is it really?"
"I have army engineers heading there now to make a full assessment of the damage and to commence repairs. I am confident that we can restore service shortly. We have skilled bridging engineers, you know."
"Luo," Qian said, "your magic army bridges can support a tank or a truck, yes. but not a locomotive that weighs 200 tons pulling a train weighing 4,000. Now what else has gone wrong with your Siberian adventure? It is foolish to think that the other side will simply lie down and die. Of course they fight back. But we have superior forces in theater, and we will smash them. We will have that new gold mine in our pocket before this meeting is over, the defense minister promised. But the pledge seemed hollow to some of those around the table. What else? Chian persisted. The American Naval Air Forces attacked last night and succeeded in sinking some of our South Sea Fleet units. Which units? Well, we have no word from our missile submarine, and... They sank our only missile submarine? Premier Xu asked. How is this possible? Was it sitting in harbor? No, Luo admitted. It was at sea, in company with another nuclear submarine. And that one is also possibly lost. Marvelous, Tong Jie observed. Now the Americans strike at our strategic assets. That's half our nuclear deterrent gone, and that was the safe half of it. What goes on, Luo? What is happening now? At his seat, Fang Gan took note of the fact that Zhang was strangely subdued. Ordinarily, he would have leapt to Luo's defense, but except for the one conciliatory comment, he was leaving the defense minister to flap in the wind. What might that mean? What do we tell the people? Fang asked, trying to center the meeting on something important. The people will believe what they are told, Luo said. And everyone nodded nervous agreement on that one. They did control the media. The American CNN news service had been turned off all over the People's Republic, along with all Western news services, even in Hong Kong, which usually enjoyed much looser reins than the rest of the country. But the thing no one addressed, but everyone knew to worry about, was that every soldier had a mother and a father who'd notice when the mail home stopped coming. Even in a nation as tightly controlled as the PRC, you couldn't stop the truth from getting out. Or rumors, which, though false, could be even worse than an adverse truth. People would believe things other than those they were told to believe, if those other things made more sense than the official truth proclaimed by their government in Beijing. Truth was something so often feared in this room, Fang realized, and for the first time in his life he wondered why that had to be. If the truth was something to fear, might that mean they were doing something wrong in here? But no, that couldn't be true, could it? Didn't they have a perfect political model for reality? Wasn't that Mao's bequest to their country? But if that were true, why did they fear having the people find out what was really happening? Could it be that they, the Politburo members, could handle the truth, and the peasantry could not? But then, if they feared having the peasantry get hold of the truth, didn't that have to mean that the truth was harmful to the people sitting in this room? And if the truth was a danger to the peasants and workers, then didn't they have to be wrong? Fang suddenly realized how dangerous was the thought that had just entered his mind. Luo, what does it mean to us strategically, the Interior Minister asked, if the Americans remove half of our strategic weapons? Was that done deliberately? If so, for what cause? Tong, you do not sink a ship by accident. And so, yes, the attack on our missile submarine must have been a deliberate act, Luo answered. So the Americans deliberately removed from the table one of our only methods for attacking them directly? Why? Was that not a political act, not just a military one? The defense minister nodded. Yes, you could see it that way. Can we expect the Americans to strike at us directly? To this date they have struck some bridges, but what about our government and vital industries? Might they strike directly at us? Tong went on. That would be unwise. We have missiles targeted at their principal cities. They know this. Since they disarmed themselves of nuclear missiles some years ago, well, they still have nuclear bombs that can be delivered by bombers and tactical aircraft, of course, but not the ability to strike at us in the way that we could strike at them. And the Russians, of course. How sure are we that they are disarmed?
Tong persisted. "If they have ballistic arms, they've concealed it from everyone," Tan Dashi told them all. Then he shook his head decisively. "No, they have no more." "And that gives us an advantage, doesn't it?" Zhang asked, with a ghoulish smile. USS Gettysburg was alongside the floating pier in the York River. Once the warheads for Trident missiles had been stored here, and there must still have been some awaiting dismantlement, because there were Marines to be seen, and only Marines were entrusted to guard the Navy's nuclear weapons. But none of those were on the pier. No, the trucks that rolled out from the weapons depot were carrying long, square cross-sectioned boxes that contained SM-2ER Block 4D surface-to-air missiles. When the trucks got to the cruiser, a traveling crane lifted them up to the foredeck of the ship, where, with the assistance of some strong-backed sailors, the boxes were rapidly lowered into the vertical launch cells of the forward missile launcher. It took about 4 minutes per box, Gregory saw, with the captain pacing his wheelhouse all the while. Gregory knew why. He had an order to take his cruiser right to Washington, D.C., and the order had the word expedite on it. Evidently, expedite was a word with special meaning for the United States Navy, like having your wife call for you from the baby's room at 2 in the morning. The 10th box was duly lowered, and the crane swung clear of the ship. "Mr. Richardson," Captain Blandy said to the officer of the deck. "Yes, sir," the lieutenant answered. "Let's get underway." Gregory walked out on the bridge wing to watch. The special sea detail cast off the 6-inch hawsers, and scarcely had they fallen clear of the cleats on the main deck when the cruiser's auxiliary power unit started pushing the 10,000 tons of gray steel away from the floating pier. And the ship was for sure in a hurry. She was not 15 feet away when the main engine started turning, and less than a minute after that Gregory heard the whoosh of the 4 jet turbines taking a big gulp of air, and he could feel the ship accelerate for the Chesapeake Bay, almost like being on a city transit bus. "Dr. Gregory?" Captain Blandy had stuck his head out the pilot house door. "Yeah, Captain?" "You want to get below and do your software magic on our birds?" "You bet." He knew the way, and in 3 minutes was at the computer terminal which handled that task. "Hey, Doc," Senior Chief Leak said, sitting down next to him. "All ready? I'm supposed to help." "Okay, you can watch, I suppose." The only problem was that it was a clunky system, about as user-friendly as a chainsaw. But, as Leak had told him a week before, this was the flower of 1975 technology, back when an Apple II with 64K of RAM was the cat's own ass. Now he had more computing power in his wristwatch. Each missile had to be upgraded separately, and each was a 7-step process. "Hey, wait a minute," Gregory objected. The screen wasn't right. "Doc, we loaded 6 Block 4D. The other 2 are stock SM-2ER Block 3C radar homers. What can I tell you? Captain Blandy's conservative." "So I only do the upgrade on holes 1 through 6? "No, do 'em all. It'll just ignore the changes you made to the infrared homing code. The chips on the birds can handle the extra code, no sweat. Right, Mr. Olson?" "Correct, Senior Chief," Lieutenant Olson confirmed. "The missiles are current technology, even if the computer system isn't. It probably costs more to make missile seeker heads with current technology that can talk to this old kludge than it would to buy a new gateway to upgrade the whole system, not to mention having a more reliable system overall. But you'll have to talk to NAVC about that." "Who?" Gregory asked. "Naval Sea Systems Command. They're the technical geniuses who won't put stabilizers on these cruisers. They think it's good for us to puke in a seaway." "Feather merchants," Leak explained. "Navy's full of 'em, on land anyway." The ship heeled strongly to starboard. "Captain's in a hurry, ain't he?" Gregory observed. Gettysburg was making a full-speed right-angle turn to port. "Well, Sacklant said it's the SecDef's idea. I guess that makes it important," Mr. Olson told their guest.
"I think this is imprudent," Fang told them all.
"Why is that?"
Luo asked.
"Is fueling the missiles necessary? Is there not a danger of provocation?"
"I suppose this is a technical matter," Qian said. "As I recall, once you fuel them, you cannot keep them fueled for more than, what, 12 hours?
The technocrat caught the defense minister off guard with that question. He didn't know the answer.
"I will have to consult with second artillery for that," he admitted.
"So then, you will not prepare them for launch until we have a chance to consider the matter?" Qian asked.
"Why, of course not," Luo promised.
"And so the real problem is, how do we tell the people what has transpired in Siberia?"
"The people will believe what we tell them to believe," Luo said yet again.
"Comrades," Qian said, struggling to keep his voice reasonable, "we cannot conceal the rising of the sun. Neither can we conceal the loss of our rail transport system. Nor can we conceal the large-scale loss of life. Every soldier has parents, and when enough of them realize their son is lost, they will speak of it, and the word will get out.
We must face facts here. It is better, I think, to tell the people that there is a major battle going on, and there has been loss of life. To proclaim that we are winning when we may not be is dangerous for all of us."
"You say the people will rise up?" Tong Jie asked.
"No, but I say there could be dissatisfaction and unrest. And it is in our collective interest to avoid that, is it not?" Qian asked the assembly.
"How will the adverse information get out?" Luo asked.
"It frequently does," Qian told them. "We can prepare for it, and mitigate the effect of adverse information, or we can try to withstand it. The former offers mild embarrassment to us. The latter, if it fails, could be more serious. The TV will show what we wish them to show, and the people will see nothing else. Besides, General Ping and his army group are advancing even as we speak."
"What do they call it?"
"This one's Grace Kelly. The other two are Marilyn Monroe and... I can't remember," General Moore said. "Anyway, they named them for movie stars."
"And how do they transmit?"
"The Dark Star uploads directly to a communications satellite, encrypted, of course, and we distribute it out of Fort Belvoir."
"So we can send it out any way we want?"
"Yes, sir."
"Okay, Ed, the Chinese are telling their people what?"
"They started off by saying the Russians committed a border intrusion and they counterattacked. They're also saying that they're kicking Ivan's ass."
"Well, that's not true. And it'll be especially untrue when they reach the Russian stop line. That Bondarenko guy's really played his cards beautifully. They're pretty strung out. We've chopped their supply line for fair, and they're heading into a real motherfucker of an ambush," the DCI told them.
"How about it, General?"
"The Chinese just don't know what's ahead of them. You know, out at the NTC we keep teaching people that he who wins the reconnaissance battle wins the war. The Russians know what's happening. The Chinese do not. My God, this Dark Star has really exceeded our expectations."
"It's some shiny new toy, Mickey," Jackson agreed. "Like going to a Vegas casino when you're able to read the cards halfway through the deck. You just can't hardly lose this way."
The president leaned forward.
"You know, one of the reasons we took it on the chin with Vietnam is how the people got to see the war every night on Huntley Brinkley. How will it affect the Chinese if their people see the war the same way, but live this time?"
"The battle that's coming? It'll shake them up a lot," Ed Foley thought. "But how do we..."
Oh, yeah.
"Holy shit, Jack, are you serious?"
"Can we do it?" Ryan asked.
"Technically, it's child's play. My only beef is that it really lets people know one of our capabilities. This is sensitive stuff. I mean, right up there with the performance of our reconnaissance satellites. It's not the sort of thing you just let out."
"Why not? Hell, couldn't some university duplicate the optics?" the president asked.
"Well, yeah, I guess. The imagery systems are good, but they're not all that new a development. Except some of the thermal systems, but even so, Ed, let's say we can shock them into stopping the war. How many lives would it save?
Quite a few, the DCI admitted. Thousands. Maybe tens of thousands.
Including some of our people?
Yes, Jack, including some of ours.
And from a technical point of view, it's really child's play?
Yes, it's not technically demanding at all.
Then turn the children loose, Ed. Right now, Ryan ordered.
Yes, Mr. President.
Chapter 59, Loss of Control. With the death of General Peng, command of 34th Shock Army devolved to Major General Ge Li, CG also of 302nd Armored. His first task was to get himself clear, and this he did, ordering his tank off the long gun range slope while one of the surviving reconnaissance tracks recovered Peng's body. All of those tracked vehicles also pulled back, as Ge figured his first task was to determine what had happened, rather than to avenge the death of his army commander. It took him 20 minutes to motor back to his own command section, where he had a command track identical to the one Peng had driven about in. He needed the radios, since he knew the field phones were down. For whatever reason, he didn't know.
"I need to talk to Marshal Luo," he said over the command frequency, which was relayed back to Beijing via several repeater stations. It took another 10 minutes because the defense minister, he was told, was in a Politburo meeting. Finally, the familiar voice came over the radio.
"This is Marshal Luo.
This is Major General Ge Li, commanding 302nd Armored. General Peng Shiwang is dead," he announced.
"What happened?"
"He went forward to join the reconnaissance section to see the front, and he was killed by a sniper bullet. The recon section ran into a small ambush. Looked like a single Russian personnel carrier. I drove it off with my own tank," Ge went on. It was fairly true, and it seemed like the sort of thing he was supposed to say.
"I see. What is the overall situation?" the defense minister asked.
34th Shock Army is advancing.
Well, it was. I paused the advance to reorganize the command group.
I request instructions, Comrade Minister.
You will advance and capture the Russian gold mine, secure it, and then continue north for the oil field.
Very well, Comrade Minister, but I must advise you that 29th Army, right behind us, sustained a serious attack an hour ago, and was reportedly badly hit.
How badly?
I do not know. Reports are sketchy, but it doesn't sound good.
What sort of attack was it?
An air attack. Origin unknown. As I said, reports are very sketchy at this time. 29th seems very disorganized at the moment, Ge reported.
Very well. You will continue the attack. 43rd Army is behind 29th and will support you. Watch your left flank.
I know of the reports of Russian units to my west, Ge said. I will orient a mechanized division to deal with that, but...
But what? Luo asked.
But, Comrade Marshal, we have no reconnaissance information on what lies before us. I need such information in order to advance safely.
You will find your safety in advancing rapidly into enemy territory and destroying whatever formations you find, Luo told him forcefully. Continue your advance.
By your command, Comrade Minister.
There wasn't much else he could say to that.
Report back to me as necessary.
I will do that, Ge promised.
Very well. Out.
Static replaced the voice.
You heard him, Ge said to Colonel Hua Chenggong, whom he'd just inherited as Army Operations Officer.
Now what, Colonel?
We continue the advance, Comrade General.
Ge nodded to the logic of the situation.
Give the order.
It took hold 4 minutes later, when the radio commands filtered down to battalion level and the units started moving.
They didn't need reconnaissance information now, Colonel Hua reasoned. They knew that there had to be some light Russian units just beyond the ridgeline where Peng had met his foolish death.
Didn't I warn him? Hua raged to himself. Didn't Ge warn him?
For a general to die in battle was not unexpected. But to die from a single bullet fired by some lone rifleman was worse than foolish. 30 years of training and experience wasted, lost to a single rifleman.
"There they go again," Major Tucker said, seeing the plume of diesel exhaust followed by the lurching of numerous armored vehicles. "About 6 kilometers from your first line of tanks."
"A pity we can't get one of these terminals to Sinyavsky," Bondarenko said.
"Not that many of them, sir," Tucker told him. "Sun Microsystems is still building them for us."
"That was General Gay Lee," Luo told the Politburo. "We've had some bad luck. General Peng is dead, killed by a sniper bullet, I just learned."
"How did that happen?" Premier Xu asked.
"Peng had gone forward, as a good general should, and there was a lucky Russian out there with a rifle," the defense minister explained. Then one of his aides appeared and walked to the marshal's seat, handing him a slip of paper. He scanned it.
"This is confirmed?"
"Yes, Comrade Marshal. I requested and got confirmation myself. The ships are in sight of land even now."
"What ships? What land?" Xu asked. It was unusual for him to take an active part in these meetings. Usually he let the others talk, listened passively, and then announced the consensus conclusions reached by the others.
"Comrade," Luo answered, "it seems some American warships are bombarding our coast near Guangzhou."
"Bombarding?" Xu asked. "You mean with guns?"
"That's what the report says, yes."
"Why would they do that?" the Premier asked, somewhat nonplussed by this bit of information.
"To destroy shore emplacements, and—"
"Isn't that what one does prior to invading? A preparation to putting troops on the beach?" Foreign Minister Shan asked.
"Well, yes, it could be that, I suppose," Luo replied, "but—"
"Invasion?" Xu asked.
"A direct attack on our own soil?"
"Such a thing is most unlikely," Luo told them. "They lack the ability to put troops ashore in sufficiently large numbers. America simply doesn't have the troops to do such a—"
"What if they get assistance from Taiwan? How many troops do the bandits have?" Tong Jie asked.
"Well, they have some land forces," Luo allowed. "But we have ample ability to—"
"You told us a week ago that we had all the forces required to defeat the Russians, even if they got some aid from America," Qian observed, becoming agitated.
"What fiction do you have for us now, Luo?"
"Fiction!" the marshal's voice boomed. "I tell you the facts, but now you accuse me of that?"
"What have you not told us, Luo?" Qian asked harshly. "We are not peasants here to be told what to believe."
"The Russians are making a stand. They have fought back. I told you that. And I told you this sort of thing is to be expected, and it is. We fight a war with the Russians. It's not a burglary in an unoccupied house. This is an armed contest between 2 major powers. And we will win because we have more and better troops. They do not fight well. We swept aside their border defenses, and we've pursued their army north. And they didn't have the manhood to stand and fight for their own land. We will smash them. Yes, they will fight back. We must expect that. But it won't matter. We will smash them, I tell you," he insisted.
"Is there any information which you have not told us to this point?" Interior Minister Tong asked, in a voice more reasonable than the question itself.
"I have appointed Major General Gay to assume command of the 34th Shock Army. He reported to me that 29th Army sustained a serious air attack earlier today. The effects of this attack are not clear. Probably they managed to damage communications. And an air attack cannot seriously hurt a large mechanized land force. The tools of war do not permit such a thing."
"Now what?" Premier Xu asked.
"I propose that we adjourn the meeting and allow Minister Luo to return to his task of managing our armed forces," Zhang Hansan proposed, "and that we reconvene, say, at 16 hours.
There were nods around the table.
Everyone wanted the time to consider the things that they'd heard this morning, and perhaps to give the defense minister the chance to make good his words. Xu did a head count and stood. "Very well, we adjourn until this afternoon." The meeting broke up in an unusually subdued manner, without the usual pairing off and pleasantries between old comrades. Outside the conference room, Qian buttonholed Fang again.
"Something is going badly wrong. I can feel it."
"How sure are you of that?"
"Fang, I don't know what the Americans have done to my railroad bridges, but I assure you that to destroy them, as I was informed earlier this morning, is no small thing. Moreover, the destruction inflicted was deliberately systematic. The Americans, it must have been the Americans, deliberately crippled our ability to supply our field armies. You only do such a thing in preparation to smashing them. And now the commanding general of our advancing armies is suddenly killed. Stray bullet, my ass. That tset-hat-tset-ha Luo leads us to disaster, Fang."
"We'll know more this afternoon," Fang suggested, leaving his colleague and going to his office. Arriving there, he dictated another segment for his daily journal. For the first time, he wondered if it might turn out to be his testament. For her part, Ming was disturbed by her minister's demeanor. An elderly man, he'd always nonetheless been a calm and optimistic one for the most part. His mannerisms were those of a grandfatherly gentleman, even when taking her or one of the other office girls to his bed. It was an enduring quality, one of the reasons the office staff didn't resist his advances more vigorously. And besides, he did take care of those who took care of his needs. This time she took her dictation quietly, while he leaned back in his chair, his eyes closed, and his voice a monotone. It took half an hour, and she went out to her desk to do the transcription. It was time for the midday meal by the time she was done, and she went out to lunch with her co-worker, Chai.
"What is the matter with him?" she asked Ming.
"The meeting this morning did not go well. Fang is concerned with the war."
"But isn't it going well? Isn't that what they say on TV?"
"It seems there have been some setbacks. This morning they argued about how serious they were. Qian was especially exercised about it, because the Americans attacked our rail bridges in Harbin and Bayan."
"Ah."
Chai shoveled some rice into her mouth with her chopsticks.
"How is Fang taking it?"
"He seems very tense. Perhaps he will need some comfort this evening."
"Oh? Well, I can take care of him. I need a new office chair anyway," she added with a giggle.
Lunch dragged on longer than usual. Clearly their minister didn't need any of them for the moment, and Ming took the time to walk about on the street to gauge the mood of the people there. The feeling was strangely neutral. She was out just long enough to trigger her computer's downtime activation, and though the screen was blank, in the auto-sleep mode, the hard drive started turning, and silently activated the onboard modem. Mary Pat Foley was in her office, though it was past midnight, and she was logging onto her mail account every 15 minutes, hoping for something new from Zorga.
"You've got mail," the mechanical voice told her.
"Yes," she said back to it, downloading the document at once. Then she lifted the phone. "Get Sears up here." With that done, Mrs. Foley looked at the time entry on the email. It had gone out in the early afternoon in Beijing. What might that mean, she wondered, afraid that any irregularity could spell the death of Songbird and the loss of the Zorga documents.
"Working late?" Sears asked on entering.
"Who isn't?" MP responded. She held out the latest printout. "Read." "Politburo meeting, in the morning for a change," Sears said, scanning the first page. "Looks a little raucous. This Qian guy is raising a little hell."
Oh, okay. He chatted with Fung after it and expressed serious concerns. Agreed to meet later in the day and... Oh, shit. What's that? They discussed increasing the readiness of their ICBM force. Let's see. Nothing firm was decided for technical reasons. They weren't sure how long they could keep the missiles fueled, but they were shook by our takeout of their missile submarine. Write that up. I'm going to hang a critic on it, the DDO announced. Critic, shorthand for critical, is the highest priority in the United States government for message traffic. A critic-flagged document must be in the president's hands no less than 15 minutes after being generated. That meant that Joshua Sears had to get it drafted just as quickly as he could type in his keyboard, and that made for errors in translation. Ryan had been asleep for maybe 40 minutes when the phone next to his bed went off.
Yeah?
Mr. President, some faceless voice announced in the White House Office of Signals, we have critic traffic for you.
All right, bring it up.
Jack swung his body across the bed and planted his feet on the rug. As a normal human being living in his home, he wasn't a bathrobe person. Ordinarily, he'd just pad around his house barefoot in his underwear. But that wasn't allowed anymore, and he always kept a long blue robe handy now. It was a gift from long ago, when he'd taught history at the Naval Academy, a gift from the students there, and bore on the sleeves the one wide and four narrow stripes of a fleet admiral. So dressed, and wearing leather slippers that also came with the new job, he walked out into the upstairs corridor. The Secret Service night team was already up and moving. Joe Hilton came to him first.
We heard, sir. It's on the way up now.
Ryan, who'd been existing on less than 5 hours of sleep per night for the past week, had an urgent need to lash out and rip the face off someone, anyone. But, of course, he couldn't do that to men who were just doing their job, with miserable hours of their own. Special Agent Charlie Malone was at the elevator. He took the folder from the messenger and trotted over to Ryan. Ryan rubbed his hand over his face as he flipped the folder open. The first three lines jumped into his consciousness.
Oh, shit.
Anything wrong? Hilton asked. Phone, Ryan said. This way, sir. Hilton led him to the Secret Service upstairs cubbyhole office. Ryan lifted the phone and said, Mary patted Langley. It didn't take long. MP, Jack here. What gives?
It's just what you see. They're talking about fueling their intercontinental missiles. At least two of them are aimed at Washington.
Great. Now what?
I just tasked a KH-11 to give their launch sites a close look. There's two of them, Jack. The one we need to look at is at Chuanhua. That's about 40 degrees, 38 minutes north, 115 degrees, 6 minutes east. 12 silos with CCC-4 missiles inside. This is one of the newer ones, and it replaced older sites that stored the missiles in caves or tunnels. Straight, vertical, in-the-ground silos. The entire missile field is about 6 miles by 6 miles. The silos are well separated so that a single nuclear impact can't take out any two missiles, MP explained, manifestly looking at overheads of the place as she spoke.
How serious is this?
A new voice came on the line.
Jack, it's Ed. We have to take this one seriously. The naval bombardment on their coast might have set them off. The damn fools think we might be attempting a no-shit invasion.
What?
What with? The president demanded.
They can be very insular thinkers, Jack, and they're not always logical by our rules, Ed Foley told him.
Great. Okay, you two come on down here. Bring your best China guy with you.
On the way. The DCI replied. Ryan hung up and looked at Joe Hilton.
Wake everybody up. The Chinese may be going squirrely on us.
The drive up the Potomac River hadn't been easy. Captain Blandy hadn't wanted to wait for a river pilot to help guide him up the river.
Naval officers tend to be overly proud when it comes to navigating their ships, and that had made it quite tense for the bridge watch. Rarely was the channel more than a few hundred yards wide, and cruisers are deep-water ships, not riverboats. Once they came within a few yards of a mudbank, but the navigator got them clear of it with a timely rudder order. The ship's radar was up and running. People were actually afraid to turn off the billboard system because it, like most mechanical contrivances, preferred operation to idleness, and switching it off might have broken something. As it was, the RF energy radiating from the four huge billboard transmitters on Gettysburg superstructure had played hell with numerous television sets on the way northwest. But that couldn't be helped. And probably nobody noticed the cruiser in the river anyway. Not at this time of night. Finally, Gettysburg glided to a halt within sight of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, and had to wait for traffic to be halted on the D.C. Beltway. This resulted in the usual road rage, but at this time of night there weren't that many people to be outraged, though one or two did honk their horns when the ship passed through the open drawbridge span. Perhaps they were New Yorkers, Captain Blandy thought. From there it was another turn to starboard into the Anacostia River, through another drawbridge, this one named for John Philip Sousa, accompanied by more surprised looks from the few drivers out, and then a gentle docking alongside the pier that was also home to USS Barry, a retired destroyer relegated to museum status. The line handlers on the pier, Captain Blandy saw, were mainly civilians. Wasn't that a hell of a thing? The Evolution, that Gregory had learned was what the Navy called parking a boat, had been interesting but unremarkable to observe, though the skipper looked quite relieved to have it all behind him. Finished with engines, the CO told the engine room, and let out a long breath, shared, Gregory could see, by the entire bridge crew. "Captain?" the retired Army officer asked. "Yes." "What is this all about, exactly?" "Well, isn't it kind of obvious?" Blandy responded. "We have a shooting war with the Chinese. They have ICBMs, and I suppose the SecDef wants to be able to shoot them down if they loft one at Washington. SAC Land is also sending an Aegis to New York, and I'd bet Pacific Fleet has some looking out for Los Angeles and San Francisco. Probably Seattle, too. There's a lot of ships there anyway, and a good weapons locker. Do you have spare copies of your software?" "Sure." "Well, we'll have a phone line from the dock in a few minutes. We'll see if there's a way for you to upload it to other interested parties." "Oh," Dr. Gregory observed quietly. He really should have thought that one all the way through.
"This is Red Wolf 4. I have visual contact with the Chinese advance guard," the regimental commander called on the radio. "About 10 kilometers south of us."
"Very well," Sinyovsky replied. Just where Bondarenko and his American helpers said they were. Good. There were two other general officers in his command post, the CGs of 201st and 80th Motor Rifle Divisions, and the commander of the 34th was supposed to be on his way as well, though 94th had turned and reoriented itself to attack east from a point about 30 kilometers to the south. Sinyovsky took the old, sodden cigar from his mouth and tossed it out into the grass, pulling another from his tunic pocket and lighting it. It was a Cuban cigar and superb in its mildness. His artillery commander was on the other side of the map table, just a couple of planks on sawhorses, which was perfect for the moment. Close by were holes dug should the Chinese send some artillery fire their way, and, most important of all, the wires which led to his communication station, set a full kilometer to the west. That was the first thing the Chinese would try to shoot at, because they'd expect him to be there. In fact, the only humans present were 4 officers and 7 sergeants, in armored personnel carriers dug into the ground for safety. It was their job to repair anything the Chinese might manage to break.
"So, comrades, they come right into our parlor, eh?" he said for those around him.
Sinyovsky had been a soldier for 26 years, Oddly, he was not the son of a soldier. His father was an instructor in geology at Moscow State University. But ever since the first war movie he'd seen, this was the profession he'd craved to join. He'd done all the work, attended all the schools, studied history with the manic attention common in the Russian army, and the Red Army before it. This would be his Battle of the Kursk Bulge, remembering the battle where Vatutin and Rokossovsky had smashed Hitler's last attempt to retake the offensive in Russia, where his mother country had begun the long march that had ended at the Reich Chancellery in Berlin. There, too, the Red Army had been the recipient of brilliant intelligence information, letting them know the time, place, and character of the German attack, and so allowing them to prepare so well that even the best of the German field commanders, Erich von Manstein, could do no more than break his teeth on the Russian steel. "And so it will be here," Sinyavsky promised himself. The only unsatisfactory part was that he was stuck here in this camouflaged tent instead of in the line with his men. But no, he wasn't a captain anymore, and his place was here, to fight the battle on a goddamned printed map. "Red Wolf, you will commence firing when the advance guard gets to within 800 meters."
800 meters, Comrade General," the commander of his tank regiment acknowledged. "I can see them quite clearly now."
"What exactly can you see?"
"It appears to be a battalion-strength formation, principally Type 90 tanks, some Type 98s, but not too many of those, spread out as though they went to sub-unit commanders. Numerous tracked personnel carriers. I do not see any artillery-spotting vehicles, however."
"What do we know of their artillery?"
"It's rolling, not set up for firing." "We're watching them," Sinyavsky assured him.
"Excellent. They are now 2 kilometers off by my rangefinder."
"Stand by."
"I will do that, Command."
"I hate waiting," Sinyavsky commented to the officers around him. They all nodded, having the same prejudice. He hadn't seen Afghanistan in his younger years, having served mainly in 1st and 2nd Guards tank armies in Germany back then, preparing to fight against NATO, an event which, blessedly, had never taken place. This was his very first experience with real combat, and it hadn't really started yet, and he was ready for it to start.
"Okay, if they light those missiles up, what can we do about it?" Ryan asked.
"If they launch 'em, there's not a goddamn thing but run for cover," Secretary Brentano said.
"That's good for us. We'll all get away. What about the people who live in Washington, New York, and all the other supposed targets?" POTUS asked.
"I've ordered some Aegis cruisers to the likely targets that are near the water," Thunder went on. "I had one of my people from TRW look at the possibility of upgrading the missile systems to see if they might do an intercept. He's done the theoretical work, and he says it looks good on the simulators. But that's a ways from a practical test, of course. It's better than nothing, though."
"Okay, where are the ships?"
"There's one here now," Brentano answered.
"Oh, when did that happen?" Robbie Jackson asked.
"Less than an hour ago. Gettysburg. There's another one going to New York, and San Francisco and Los Angeles. Also Seattle, though that's not really a target as far as we know. The software upgrade is going out to them to get their missiles reprogrammed."
"Okay, that's something. What about taking those missiles out before they can launch?" Ryan asked next.
"The Chinese silos have recently been upgraded in protection. Steel armor on the concrete covers. Shaped like a Chinese coolie hat. It will probably deflect most bombs, but not the deep penetrators, the GBU-27s we used on the railroad bridges. If they have any left over there, better ask Gus Wallace," the vice president warned.
"What do you mean?" Brentano asked.
"I mean we never made all that many of them, and the Air Force must have dropped about 40 last night."
"I'll check that," SecDef promised.
"What if he doesn't?" Jack asked.
"Then either we get some more in one big hurry, or we think up something else," Tomcat replied.
"Like what, Robbie?"
"Hell, send in a special operations team and blow them the fuck up," a former fighter pilot suggested.
I wouldn't much want to try that myself, Mickey Moore observed.
Beats the hell out of a 5-megaton bomb going off on Capitol Hill, Mickey, Jackson shot back. Look, the preferred thing to do is find out if Gus Wallace has the right bombs. It's a long stretch for the black jets, but you can tank them going and coming, and put fighters up to protect the tankers. It's complicated, but we practice that sort of thing. If he doesn't have the goddamn bombs, we fly them to him, assuming there are any. You know, weapon storage isn't a cornucopia, guys. There's a finite, discrete number for every item in the inventory.
General Moore, Ryan said, call General Wallace and find out, right now, if you would.
Yes, sir.
Moore stood and left the Situation Room.
Look, Ed Foley said, pointing to the TV. It started.
The wood line erupted in a sheet of flame 2 kilometers across. The sight caused the eyes of the Chinese tankers to flare, but most of the front rank of tank crews didn't have time for much more than that. Of the 30 tanks in that line, only 3 escaped immediate destruction. It was little better for the personnel carriers interspersed with them.
"You may commence firing, Colonel," Sinyavsky told his artillery commander.
The command was relayed at once, and the ground shook beneath their feet. It was spectacular to see on the computer terminal. The Chinese had walked straight into the ambush, and the effect of the Russian opening volley was ghastly to behold. Major Tucker took in a deep breath as he saw several hundred men lose their lives.
"Back to their artillery," Bondarenko ordered.
"Yes, sir." Tucker complied at once, altering the focus of the high-altitude camera and finding the Chinese artillery. It was mainly of the towed sort, being pulled behind trucks and tractors. They were a little slow getting the word. The first Russian shells were falling around them before any effort was made to stop the trucks and lift the limbers off the towing hooks. And for all that, the Chinese gunners worked rapidly. But theirs was a race against death, and death had a head start. Tucker watched one gun crew struggle to manhandle their 122-millimeter gun into a firing position. The gunners were loading the weapon when 3 shells landed close enough to upset the weapon and kill more than half their number. Zooming in the camera, he could see one private writhing on the ground, and there was no one close by to offer him assistance.
"It is a miserable business, isn't it?" Bondarenko observed quietly.
"Yeah," Tucker agreed. When a tank blew up, it was easy to tell yourself that a tank was just a thing. Even though you knew that 3 or 4 human beings were inside, you couldn't see them. As a fighter pilot never killed a fellow pilot, but only shot down his aircraft, so Tucker adhered to the Air Force ethos that death was something that happened to objects rather than people. Well, that poor bastard with blood on his shirt wasn't a thing, was he? He backed off the camera, taking a wider field that permitted godlike distancing from the up-close and personal aspects of the observation.
"Better that they should have remained in their own country, Major," the Russian explained to him.
"Jesus, what a mess," Ryan said. He'd seen death up close and personal himself in his time, having shot people who had at the time been quite willing to shoot him. But that didn't make this imagery any the more palatable. "Not by a long fucking shot." The president turned.
"Is this going out, Ed?" he asked the DCI.
"Ought to be," Foley replied. And it was. On a URL, Uniform Resource Locator in NetSpeak, called http://www.darkstarfeed.cia.gov/siberiabattle/realtime.ram. It didn't even have to be advertised. Some net crawlers stumbled onto it in the first 5 minutes, and the hits from people looking at the streaming video site climbed up from 0 to 10 in a matter of 3 minutes. Then some of them must have ducked into chat rooms to spread the word. The monitoring program for the URL at CIA headquarters also kept track of the locations of the people logging into it.
The first Asian country, not unexpectedly, was Japan, and the fascination of the people there in military operations guaranteed a rising number of hits. The video also included audio, the real-time comments of Air Force personnel giving some perverse color commentary back to their comrades in uniform. It was sufficiently colorful that Ryan commented on it.
"It's not meant for anyone much over the age of 30 to hear," General Moore said, coming back into the room.
"What's the story on the bombs?" Jackson asked at once.
"He's only got two of them," Moore replied. "The nearest others are at the factory, Lockheed Martin, Sunnyvale. They're just doing a production run right now."
"Uh-oh," Robbie observed, "back to Plan B."
"It might have to be a special operation, then, unless, Mr. President, that is, you are willing to authorize a strike with cruise missiles."
"What kind of cruise missiles?" Ryan asked, knowing the answer even so.
"Well, we have 28 of them on Guam with W-80 warheads. They're little ones, only about 300 pounds. It has two settings, 150 or 170 kilotons."
"Thermonuclear weapons, you mean?"
General Moore let out a breath before replying.
"Yes, Mr. President."
"That's the only option we have for taking those missiles out?"
He didn't have to say that he would not voluntarily launch a nuclear strike.
"We could go in with conventional smart bombs, GBU-10s and 15s. Gus has enough of those, but not deep penetrators, and the protection on the silos would have a fair chance at deflecting the weapon away from the target. Now, that might not matter. The CSS-4 missiles are delicate bastards, and the impact even of a miss could scramble their guidance systems. But we couldn't be sure."
"I'd prefer that those things not fly."
"Jack, nobody wants them to fly," the Vice President said. "Mickey put together a plan. We need something to take them out. And we need it in one big fucking hurry."
"I'll call SOCOM about it, but hell, they're down in Tampa."
"Do the Russians have special operations people?" Ryan asked.
"Sure, it's called Spetsnaz."
"And some of these missiles are targeted on Russia?"
"It certainly appears so, yes, sir," the chairman of the Joint Chiefs confirmed.
"Then they owe us one, and they damn well owe it to themselves," Jack said, reaching for a phone.
"I need to talk to Sergei Golovko in Moscow," he told the operator.
"The American president," his secretary said.
"Ivan Nemetovich," Golovko said in hearty greeting. "The reports from Siberia are good."
"I know, Sergei. I'm watching it live now myself."
"Want to do it yourself?"
"It is possible."
"You have a computer with a modem?"
"One cannot exist without the damned things," the Russian replied.
Ryan read off the URL identifier.
"Just log on to that. We're putting the feed from our Darkstar drones onto the Internet."
"Why is that, Jack?" Golovko asked at once.
"Because as of 2 minutes ago, 1,650 Chinese citizens are watching it, and the number is going up fast."
"A political operation against them, yes? You wish to destabilize their government?"
"Well, it won't hurt our purposes if their citizens find out what's happening, will it?"
"The virtues of a free press. I must study this."
"Very clever, Ivan Nemetovich."
"That's not why I called."
"Why is that, Tovarish President?" the SVR chairman asked,
with sudden concern at the change in his tone. Ryan was not one to conceal his feelings well.
"Sergei, we have a very adverse indication from their Politburo. I'm faxing it to you now," he heard. "I'll stay on the line while you read it." Golovko wasn't surprised to see the pages arrive on his personal fax machine. He had Ryan's personal numbers, and the Americans had his. It was just one way for an intelligence service to demonstrate its prowess in a harmless way. The first sheets to come across were the English translation of the Chinese ideographs that came through immediately thereafter.
"Sergei, I sent you our original feed in case your linguists or psychologists are better than ours," the president said, with an apologetic glance at Dr. Sears. The CIA analyst waved it off. "They have 12 CSS-4 missiles,
half aimed at you, half at us. I think we need to do something about those things. They may not be entirely rational the way things are going now.
And you're sure bombardment might have pushed them to the edge, Mr. President, the Russian said over the speakerphone. I agree this is a matter of some concern. Why don't you bomb the things with your brilliant bombs from your magical invisible bombers?
Because we're out of bombs, Sergei. They ran out of the sort they need.
Ничего, was the reaction.
You should see it from my side. My people are thinking about a commando-type operation.
I see. Let me consult with some of my people. Give me 20 minutes, Mr. President.
Okay, you know where to reach me.
Ryan punched the kill button on the phone and looked sourly at the tray of coffee things.
One more cup of this shit and I'm going to turn into an urn myself.
The only reason he was alive now, he was sure, was that he'd withdrawn to the command section for 34th Army. His tank division was being roughly handled. One of his battalions had been immolated in the first minute of the battle. Another was now trying to maneuver east, trying to draw the Russians out into a running battle for which his men were trained. The division's artillery had been halved at best by Russian massed fire, and 34th Army's advance was now a thing of the past. His current task was to try and use his two mechanized divisions to establish a base of fire from which he could try to wrest back control of the battle. But every time he tried to move a unit, something happened to it, as though the Russians were reading his mind.
"Wah, pull what's left of 302nd back to the 10 o'clock start line and do it now," he ordered.
"But Marshal Luo won't. And if he wishes to relieve me, he can. But he isn't here now, is he?"
Gay snarled back. "Give the order."
"Yes, Comrade General."
"With this toy in our hands, the Germans would not have made it as far as Minsk," Bondarenko said.
"Yeah, it helps to know what the other guy's doing, doesn't it?"
"It's like being a god on Mount Olympus. Who thought this thing up?"
"Oh, a couple of people at Northrop started the idea, with an airplane called Tacit Rainbow. Looked like a cross between a snow shovel and a French baguette. But it was manned, and the endurance wasn't so good."
"Whoever it is, I would like to buy him a bottle of good vodka," the Russian general said. "This is saving the lives of my soldiers."
"And beating the living shit out of the Chinese," Tucker didn't add. "But combat was that sort of game, wasn't it?"
"Do you have any other aircraft up?"
"Yes, sir. Grace Kelly's back up to cover First Armored."
"Show me."
Tucker used his mouse to shrink one video window and then opened another. General Diggs had a second terminal up and running, and Tucker just stole its take. There were what looked like two brigades operating, moving north at a measured pace and wrecking every Chinese truck and track they could find. The battlefield, if you could call it that, was a mass of smoke columns from shot-up trucks, reminding Tucker of the vandalized Kuwaiti oil fields of 1991. He zoomed in to see that most of the work was being done by the Bradleys. What targets there were simply were not worthy of a main gun round from the tanks. The Abrams just rode herd on the lighter infantry carriers, doing protective overwatch as they ground mercilessly forward. The Major slaved one camera to his terminal and went scouting around for more action.
"Who's this?" Tucker asked.
"Oh, that must be Boyar," Bondarenko said.
It was what looked like 25 T-55 tanks advancing online, and these tanks were using their main guns against trucks and some infantry carriers.
"Load heat," Lieutenant Komonov ordered. "Target track, 1 o'clock, range 2,000.
"I have him," the gunner said a second later.
"Fire."
"Firing," the gunner said, squeezing the trigger. The old tank rocked backwards from the shot. Gunner and commander watched the tracer arcing out.
"Over, damn it, too high. Load another heat."
The loader slammed another round into the breech in a second.
"Loaded."